Hi there, this is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the N. Savvides Podcast. This is a show about the art of collaboration, about working well with others to do great, creative, imaginative things. Sometimes we also talk about trying to make the world better in some way. Our guest today is Alex Ferrari. He's a man of many hats. Back in the day, his short film Broken got embraced by Roger Ebert, and that helped put him on the map for the film festival circuit. Recently, he directed his first feature film, This Is Meg, and it should be available on iTunes this summer. And he's working as a colorist on various projects, including Dimension 404, a new web series on Hulu, which seems to be a reimagining of the Twilight Zone for the internet era. It's narrated by Mark Hamill, and it has guest actor appearances from the likes of comedian Patton Oswalt, Lea Michele from Glee, Joel McHale from Community, and so on. Alex also works as a post-production supervisor and consultant. He's also an editor and so many other things. But many of you all probably know him as the host of the popular podcast and blog Indie Film Hustle, where he shares all kinds of insights about surviving and thriving in today's film industry. In this episode, we discuss Alex's experience as a post-production supervisor and things to keep in mind that will affect post even from the beginning. We also talk about why it's important for filmmakers and artists to build their audience before they have a big project that they're ready to share, and why it might not make sense for everyone to start off trying to imitate the Hollywood style. Plus, we also talk about the ups and downs that come with the film industry, and Alex has a very distinct way of describing it. If you stick around all the way to the end, you'll get to hear my way of wrestling with the film industry and where I'm at now and my ongoing uncanny encounters with the number 23. All that and more coming up next. Stick around. This is the N. Savvides Podcast. Hello, hello, hello. Alex Ferrari, welcome to the N. Savvides Podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
So, in addition to shooting your own films, you also do work as an editor, a post-production supervisor, and a colorist. Mm-hmm. Of those, is there something that you enjoy more and why?
For me, color grading is something I really enjoy dramatically. Editing my own stuff, I absolutely love, because that's kind of when the story gets put together. But color grading, it's become a big love of mine, because the movie comes alive, and the emotion that you can achieve by, you know, adjusting the colors appropriately is kind of exciting to me, and it has been for better part of a decade that I've been doing it, and it never ceases to amaze me how good something could look from something that might have not been shot that good.
Yeah.
My stuff included.
and there is a bit of play to it, because with editing, it's sort of like you got to hit the story notes. With color grading, I mean, you don't want to blow out the highlights, but there's more room to play than...
Yeah, absolutely. You could play around. You can create different looks. You can create different emotions, different styles. You know, I call it digital cinematography in a lot of ways. I have a tremendous respect for cinematographers and what they do. Even though I photographed my last movie, I do not call myself a cinematographer by any stretch of the imagination. In color grading is where I saved and I created the look for my movie, This Is Meg. And also in color grading, you kind of really see the soft underbelly of not only the camera, but for better or worse, what the DP was able to do on the set that day. So you can't hide in color grading. Like, it's there. And I can see, oh, he didn't have enough time to set that light up that he really wanted to, or she really wanted to. And I know that feeling firsthand from shooting my movie and knowing what I had to do that day and how I was able to make it look halfway decent. But color grading is a big love of mine.
And you're doing color grading in Resolve these days, right?
Yes, I started out in color, Apple Color, back in the day. And I actually did theatrical releases off of that. I can't believe I did. But yeah, I worked on theatrically released films on color. But once DaVinci was bought by Blackmagic, it became a little bit more affordable to own and build your own color grading system and learn that way. And it changed the game. And now I also edit in DaVinci as well.
I've seen that workflow. I haven't quite gotten there to edit on it yet, but it does seem like an interesting approach. But for you, when you're shooting some of your footage and then color grading it, do you shoot a little conservatively? Like, do you underexpose knowing that you can pull some of it back? Or do you get the highlights right and worry about the shadows later?
I generally shoot down the middle. Sometimes I'll underexpose it a little bit in the LUT that I use. Excuse me, I don't underexpose, I overexpose a little bit. I pretend that I'm underexposing in the camera when I'm looking at it, but I've actually faked the LUT a little bit, so I have to pump more light in. So when I get it into color grading, I just pull back a little bit, because it's a lot easier to pull back than it is to push. When you push is when you get artifacting and noise and things like that. When you pull back, it's a lot easier. And I've been doing that since my very first film on Mini DV. You just pump a lot of light in, obviously protecting the highlights, but it's also depending on the format you're shooting on, the camera you're shooting on. And I shot my film on Blackmagic cinema camera, which has about 14, 15 stops of latitude. And I was surprised at how well it protected the highlights.
And you're shooting raw when you're doing that?
I shot raw, yeah. And you couldn't, the stuff that I was able to do on This Is Meg, I wouldn't have been able to do any other way than by shooting raw. If I would have shot ProRes, I would have been screwed in many, many scenes that I just didn't have the manpower or time to light properly. So the raw file, I was just shocked at how much information it held.
So it sounds like that can be a technique for people who are shooting with limited budgets, limited crews, mm-hmm. to say, all right, well, I'm going to plan for this. I can shoot raw and have a little bit of latitude and in the highlights and make some adjustments in the color grade.
Absolutely. You got to find, whenever you guys are shooting something, you got to find a camera that's going to work with you and not against you. A lot of the DSLRs, they are getting better and they're out there, but they just generally are, sometimes they're just, they don't have the latitude that some of the bigger cameras do. But with that being said, I just got myself a Sony A7S II, and that camera has better latitude than an Alexa.
Oh, really? That's a bold statement.
It's not a bold statement. It's the truth. I mean, it's just straight up. It's built to do that. Does the Alexa look better? Absolutely, in my opinion. No question. The image on the Alexa is much better. And it holds. Don't get me wrong. The Alexa holds. But for the price, a Sony A7S II is insane. I mean, the way it digs into the dark, you literally could shoot almost in the dark. And it will see far beyond your eye and get a clean image. That's what's shocking about a camera like that. They just did, I think, Lionsgate or one of these, not main studios, but kind of mini majors. They're starting to shoot a lot of horror movies with the Sony A7S II because you don't need a lot of light. So you don't have to bring out a whole lot of light. You can kind of just shape it a little bit, bring it into post, and get a really respectable, good image. And move very quickly because, you know, you could shoot five or six cameras because they only cost $3,000, you know. So it's pretty insane. But that camera's is something I'm going to be shooting with in the future. And I'm also going to be getting a Blackmagic Ursa. That's going to be my big boy, my 4.6K.
In the arsenal.
Yeah, gotta build it out a little bit. But yeah, and certain things, like if you're going to go and steal something in the streets of L.A., the Ursa is not the camera to use, but the A7S is. You can go anywhere and shoot anywhere.
Are you saying you sometimes don't get permits for every single shoot that you do there, Alex?
Yes.
Okay, good. Hypothetically, if someone, in theory, would. All right. Yeah. So
No. Look, as filmmakers, we all got to kind of do what we got to do. We got to be safe about it as well. Obviously, I'm not saying go out in the middle of the street and shoot something. But in a town like LA, where, you know, everyone's shooting everything.
Yeah, and everyone's always looking to milk you for it too. Like, oh, you're exactly. a filmmaker? Yeah, that's going to be...
That's going to be $1,000.
Right.
You know, it's cost prohibitive to go out and shoot a feature film. So like on Meg, I basically stole the Hollywood sign. So, and I was kind of scared about going out there and shooting it. And I had a decent sized rig, all this kind of stuff. I was like really scared, but I started doing that hike up to the Hollywood sign. Halfway up, I'm like, I could literally shoot anything else I want up here and no one's going to do anything, because by the time someone gets to me, I've already shot it.
Right. Did you have your fanny pack set so you could pretend to be a tourist kind of thing?
Oh, no. I just had a backpack. Okay. There was no pretending. And that's another great thing about being in LA. When I was at the very top of the Hollywood sign shooting scene, everybody that was up there, obviously that we weren't the only people up there. They're like, am I in your shot? Oh, let me know. Well, I'll wait. You things like that. Everyone was so accommodating, you know? So it was just like, wow, I had nothing to worry about. So, but yeah, sometimes you kind of gorilla it out and, you know, you got to steal stuff. I just interviewed someone on my podcast yesterday that they went around and stole, I think, 20 locations in New York.
Wow.
You know,
that's impressive.
They were shooting on a red, you know, and they just went out there and just started shooting. So you got to do what you got to do sometimes. Be safe about it, but you know, look, there is not one director ever that's made it in Hollywood or is making a living as a director who has not stolen a shot. Even on the biggest movies ever, sometimes I'll just go and grab something.
All right. Well, speaking of your podcast, Indie Film Hustle, you work with a number of filmmakers. And as we said, you also do some post-production work. It gives you a broad view of the process. Are there hang-ups that you see filmmakers making throughout the filmmaking process, and how can they avoid some of those things?
My God, do you have 6 or 7 hours?
I mean, you know, broadly here, right? Let's look at the big picture.
So depending on the stage you're looking at. So if in pre-productions, there's problems in production, there's problems in post-production, there's problems in distribution, there's problems. And even creating the script, there's problems. So where would you like me to kind of say, at least in my experience?
Yeah, right. So I should have been more specific. I mean, in particular with post, right? What mm-hmm. kinds of things can people keep in mind for post, even in the pre-production stages, that would make things a little easier for you or for the filmmakers at that stage?
The biggest piece of advice I can give any filmmaker making any kind of movie is to either hire a post-production supervisor or consult a post-production supervisor, because that's where I see movies die in post, because they did not create a proper workflow to get from camera to an editing system, from an editing system to a color suite, from a color suite to an online suite, and to get your final deliverables out, get your audio in, all that kind of stuff, to get it into the festivals or to get it into distribution. That's the biggest problem I see. Just filmmakers who have no idea, because it's just not their job. They don't know any better, or they think that they're like, oh, I'll just shoot it on a red and edit on my laptop, you know, and I'll shoot 5K because my friend gave me that camera for free for the weekend and I'll go shoot with it, not thinking down the line that if you shoot with a large format camera like that, let's say you're shooting 5K red, like a 2:1 or 3:1 or even 5 or 6:1, those are huge files. And if you don't have an editing system that can handle that, well, there's stumbling block number one. And then you have to transcode it if you have a smaller system. So then you got to transcode it. That could take days, depending on how much you shoot, because you don't have a red rocket card to speed things up. So then once that's done, if let's say you're editing it in, God forbid, Lightworks or Sony Vegas, because you're using those. And by the way, anyone who is using either of those things, I'm not apologizing. You need to stop right now and don't use those systems. use something like Premiere.
All three of those people in the United States are now angry, but you know.
You'd be surprised. I just got someone who emailed like, yeah, I'm editing on Lightworks. I'm like, you need to stop that. Why would you do that to yourself? Anyway.
Is it part of a museum exhibit? Like, this is how it was done?
DaVinci is free. It's free, for God's sakes. And it works wonderfully for, you know, it's amazing. So, you know, so I would find an editing system to make sure that that editing system works with the color grading system or online system that you're going to be using down the line. And that's another big hiccup that I always find is people work in Premiere and they didn't set their project up properly. They didn't do things right. And all of a sudden they send over an EDL or they try to send over an EDL or an AAF file. I'm getting technical, so I apologize.
Yeah, so people probably have heard those terms, but let's give them a little bit more. Let's elaborate on that a little bit. So they're editing and then they're going to online. That's usually where people do the color grading as a mastering, right?
Right. In the online system, in the online world, you're going to be doing color grading. You're going to be doing any VFX, you know, exporting, outporting, importing of VFX files, titles, audio mastering, all that's done in the online. So you kind of – online is a place where you put everything together. So color grading is part of that. But usually that's a separate element in the workflow. But it all comes together in the online. And then from online, you're able to create your digital deliverables, your HDSRs, your DCPs, anything you need to actually get it out to distribution, to get it out to digital distribution or into the theaters.
These days, for filmmakers working on a budget, would you say they can still get away with doing the online at – say 1080p HD or 2K, or do you try to encourage them to say, well, maybe think about 4K?
I absolutely am against 4K.
Okay.
I think this is my reasoning for it. Not that I love shooting 4K. I think it's a wonderful format. But you know, the Ursa Mini is a 4.6K. Great. Wonderful. It's lovely. Mastering at 4K at a low budget or a smaller budget is ludicrous. It is unneeded and it's more of ego than anything else. Some people will say, oh, you're future proofing. I'm like, my friend, don't worry about it. If you have the money and you want to do it, by all means, knock yourself out. But what you're going to end up doing is mastering to 1080p because that is still the standard. I'm working on a $1 million Hulu show right now that we master at 1080p. This is a multi-million dollar show. And I'm doing all the episodes. I'm doing all the color grading, mastering, and everything. 1080p for Hulu and for Lionsgate, which will sell it internationally. So there is this myth that you have to master at 4K. No, not at all. It's a waste of time. And again, people were like, well, how about future proofing? In the next 5 years, it's going to be all 4K. I'm like, it might be, and I'm sure it will be. I'm not saying it might be. It will be at one point, but there is so much 1080p content out there that by the time it gets to the point where you need 4K, the movie you did 6 or 7 years ago, it's not going to have the market value that you might need. Or there'll be some new up-resing technology that will up-res it to 4K comfortably. So I always master, like I shot my movie at 2.5K. I mastered in 1080p because that's the monitor that I have. My broadcast monitor, color grading monitor, is a 1080p monitor. It's a huge 55-inch monitor that I use. So 2K doesn't work for me anyway. So then at 1080p, very manageable, very usable, I master in 1080p. Then I, at that point, up-resed it to 2K for my DCP, for my theatrical. For the feature films.
When you say up-res, how are you doing that?
When I say up-res, I just basically put it in a new timeline in DaVinci and it just did it for me.
I see.
It's okay. Super simple. Super simple. Because 1080p and 2K is not that far off. So in theory, and I've done this before, that's why I'm like, hey, you know, I've mastered a theatrical movie at 1080p, then bumped it up to 2K, had them burn it onto film, burn it to the DCP, saw it theatrically in a theater, and it looks stunning. And I just did that with my film a few weeks ago when I went to go see it at Cinequest when it world premiered. I looked at it in a 400-seat AMC state-of-the-art projection, and it looked like in my room. It was stunning. I couldn't believe how good it looked, you know, for a small little movie, you know, not super high-res, nothing, you know? So it doesn't, it's not something that filmmakers really need to worry about. If all you can afford is 1080p, then shoot 1080p. It's not that big of a deal. 1080p is the lowest I would go. Would not shoot 720 or anything like that. But 1080 is probably the lowest I'd go. And shoot as much, how as big as you want, as long as you can handle it. But mastering, 1080p is fine.
All right. It sounds like the up-resing tools in Resolve are fairly robust. So if it's something that works for you, if it works for Hulu, that sounds like a viable way to go for the time being.
Right. And also don't forget that 2K is the standard. Like, that is the standard for the last 100 years. You know, like, film was scanned on a 2K, you know, like, let's say now it's 2K, it's fine for projection. You know, it's gorgeous. It's fine. If you're shooting a nature documentary, you might want to shoot 4, 5, 6K because you want to get that. It's a documentary. It's a different style. It depends on the project. But for a narrative feature film, indie, there's no reason to master at 4K. It makes no sense. It's more ego than anything else. It's a waste of time and money. That's just from my opinion.
Now, Alex, what about someone who says, I want to shoot 2K or 4K, but just so that I'll have the option to crop in?
Absolutely. I would do it.
Then you're doing that in the editing stage, and then mm-hmm. you can still have the files stay at 1080 or mm-hmm. 2K when you're doing the master. How would that, mm-hmm. how would you advise someone to go through that workflow?
It's exactly what you just said. Shoot it at 4K. I mean, I shot my movie at 2.5K. I've shot at 4K. I've shot at 5K. And then I just reposition everything down in 1080p. And automatically it's going to have a 1080p aspect ratio when you create a 1080p timeline. So it'll go in there. And then once it's in there, you can reposition and not lose resolution, which is wonderful. I mean, you can just basically reshape things, you know, crop things out like a boom pole or a PA that was not supposed to be in the shot or things like that. It's wonderful. It's wonderful to be able to do all that recropping in post-production. And I love it. I mean, to shoot 1080p alone and then you're stuck with 1080p, you really need to know what you're doing and be really married to your framing. But at minimum, in today's world, 4K is not that out. I mean, it's very affordable to shoot 4K. And also, by the way, there's different kinds of 4K. So there's 4K that you shoot on in a Sony A7S2, and then there's 4K that you shoot on an Alexa or a Red. They're two very different files and two very different workflows as far as size and image quality is concerned, depth in the image file. So the A7S recording directly to that little card is going to give you a compressed file. It's not giving you a ProRes file. It's not giving you a juicy fat file with a lot of information. They're doing all that in the sensor. While in the Alexa or a Red, that actual file has a lot of depth, a lot of information. So you can do a lot more with it. You can push it and pull it in places where you might not be able to do it with a DSLR camera or a smaller camera.
And just to continue this discussion, would you clarify the differences between editing and mastering, right? Someone might be used to doing all the editing on their laptop for smaller mm-hmm. projects. So how would you transition them into thinking about doing the edit and then sending it to the mastering stage?
Oh, well, there's two different editing standpoints. There's the creative editorial and then there's online editorial. So creative editorial is exactly that. You're editing in your laptop. You're putting everything together. A lot of times online and offline or creative editorial kind of mix together. So like for me specifically when I was doing Meg, my offline was my online. So I was actually editing raw files. So I never had to re-put it back in or change it to another system. That's why I like DaVinci so much. It's all, you don't have to leave the house. You just stay in the house. So there's no problems. You don't have to go through that. But if you're editing, like let's say in Premiere on your laptop, you've got to send that information out in an EDL and in a decision list or an AAF file over to DaVinci, which then will read that information, reconnect all those files, then start the online process and reconnect it at the highest resolution possible. So it all depends on the kind of files you're using. In the old days, that was the only way you could do it. There was no like ability to edit in the highest resolution. Now you can. So offline and online, you know, if you're shooting with smaller cameras, it should be kind of the same thing almost. Like you can actually online it all in Premiere. But you have to go out to a color grading system. So then you might go out to color grading and then you might want to come back to Premiere, which has happened a lot of times, or you might want to stay in DaVinci and finish your online there. It's just, there's so many different ways of doing it. Before it was so simple. You shoot film, you did this, you did that, and that was the end of it. It was the same system for, you know, 100 years. Now it just is so many different variables that play into it, from the editing to camera to output to the online system. I mean, there's so many different variables, but generally speaking, that's kind of a workflow that I would go down.
And Resolve is a software program, but there's also the hardware-based suite that they offer. Mm-hmm. When you're working on it, are you always at the big hardware suite, or are you just using the software?
I'm using a software, a studio version. I actually paid for it.
Okay.
I have a studio version. I got a little wave color system, a color board, and it's running it on a little trash can Mac. That's it.
Okay. So in other words, it's not like it's essential to have a tricked out workstation to do some of the high end 4K quality work these days.
No. Not at all. No, you then it has nothing to do with it. Everything's gone to software based stuff. Before, DaVinci was all hardware based. Now it's software based, and all that I'm talking about is a controller. The only real hardware thing is getting video cards to push the image. So on a 4K system, you're going to have some decent video cards that are be able to push it.
Wait, what sort of video cards are you using?
I just have the internal ones that come with the Mac, and it's been fine for me. I'm going to be upgrading soon to and there's so many different video cards. I don't even know which one I'm getting yet. But just an additional video card to kind of give it a little extra juice with an external box to push it, and that's it. It's not that complicated. It used to be much more complicated. Now it's not as complicated anymore.
All right. Let's change gears a little bit and talk about some of the training that you do. You have the Indie Film Syndicate, and you have a couple of helpful courses over there. A number of those courses deal with social media promotions.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it for filmmakers or creatives to start thinking about that, to incorporate that in what they do from an early stage?
It's imperative. I mean, you can't not do it. You can't gain success in the business without doing that now. If you're an independent filmmaker and you're trying to get your movie out there, and this is a very long conversation, but I'll give you the general idea of it, is you have to ask yourself, if you're making a movie, who's your market? Who are you aiming this to, and what do you expect out of this movie? So if you expect to get that lottery ticket mentality, which I talk so much about, where I'm going to make a movie, get it into Sundance, get a deal, and live in the Hollywood Hills, that's one way of going about it. That's happened 4 or 5 times in the last 20 years. And if you want to go down that road, which a lot of my filmmakers that I know have tried, myself included, that's one way of going about it. If you're making a movie to get industry notice, that's one. You know who your customer is. If you're making an indie movie to go to a specific niche or sell directly to the public, that's another avenue of going down. You have to understand these basic questions. So who is the movie for? Why are you making it? You know, and those are questions that most filmmakers don't ask themselves. And then how social media plays into this, and tribe building or community building, that is the future of independent film. Independent film in the future will be niche based, audience based, community-based selling. So very similarly to what I've done with Indie Film Hustle, I've created a community of filmmakers and fans and people who want to learn and consume things that I'm able to create, whether that be podcasts, whether that be articles, whether that be my movie, whether it be other people's movies. I've created a community, and I've provided value to that community. And then I either sell them my movie or give them access to whatever content I create. Similarly, filmmakers have to do the same thing. They have to connect with audiences, specifically either through the niche of the movie or the niche of who they are. And there's multiple ways of going about that, whether you're trying to market yourself, your production company, or your movie. Generally speaking, I always like to market the filmmaker and or production company as opposed to just the movie, because when that movie is done, let's say you made a movie about vegan chefs and you've cultivated a wonderful vegan chef, vegans and vegetarians and all these kind of people who wanted to consume your movie, and you've built that, and now the movie's done.
Then it's going to be a tough sell when you want to make the omnivores or something, right?
Or the horror movie.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I can't really tap that audience anymore. Now, but if you find an audience that's interested in you as a filmmaker, like basically what Woody Allen did, you know, like people, and I use Woody Allen as a as an example, is that, you know, he obviously is old school, but he built up an audience for himself to the point where everybody will show up. Woody Allen film fans will show up for a Woody Allen film, regardless of what it is. And that's the goal of any filmmaker. So you make a movie and they just show up, a Martin Scorsese movie, a Stanley Kubrick movie, a Steven Spielberg movie. They've created their brand. So you have to create yourself a brand, whatever that brand might be. So without understanding social media and building your audience through social media, building your audience through websites, through blogs, other things like that. There's just so much information out there. As you've seen, because you're in the syndicate, you know, I mean, there's so many different things about marketing and social media and things like that we discuss, purely because it's so important to be able to do in the future. Because honestly, as they say, the riches are in the niches. And it's very, very true that it is, that the riches are in the niches, because if you're trying to, and this is a mistake I see so many filmmakers make, if you're trying to make a movie that's going to appeal to a broad audience, as an independent filmmaker, let's say you're making a movie that's a romantic comedy with no stars in it, and you're trying to hit the same demographic as, you know, Trainwreck did, or the latest Judd Apatow movie did, you will fail, generally speaking. You will not be able to hit that demographic because it's too broad. It's so big, you cannot even attempt to compete with a studio who has $50 to $100 million that they're going to toss into marketing to get the word out about their market to hit that demographic.
Yeah, now, or to get recognizable faces. That's not always in the budget either.
Right, exactly, or even get recognizable faces. But even if you have a recognizable face, not a star, but a recognizable face, that helps. But still, you're not going to be able to get you're not going to be able to really make an impact. But again, I'll use my vegan chef movie again. If you make a romantic comedy about a vegan chef and his troubles and tribulations of being, his love interest is a hardcore carnivore, and there's a movie right there. So I'm just throwing that. I've made that up on the fly.
Is that your gift? Like, people, listeners, anybody, you want it? Yeah, you want to make it happen?
Please, I'll watch it. So let's say that's the movie.
Okay.
Well, now you can aim at both vegans, vegetarians, and then you can also aim at paleo guys, people who are into, you know, paleo and that kind of world of carnivore eating and stuff like that, and just market it to those two different groups. And all of a sudden, you know, if you're a vegan or a vegetarian and you've got a movie about a vegan chef or a vegetarian and it's funny, you might want to watch that. And then if you're smart about it, you would create, like cooking classes, cooking lessons that you can put in as special features. You get a real cooking chef and shoot them. And there's just so many things. But do you see where I'm going with this? That it's all very niche based. So you start building out products based on that. A perfect example of that is a documentary called Food Matters. Have you ever heard of that movie? Doc?
I've heard of it. I don't know too much about it.
Food Matters is just a documentary about real food and plant-based eating and all that kind of stuff, okay? And these guys, Australian couple, made this documentary and they built an audience up around it. So they said, well, wait a minute. why don't we continue going down this route? So what they've done is they've actually built out their own streaming platform where they distribute all these kind of either food-based, nutrition-based, spiritual-based, not faith-based, but spiritual, like, you know, new age kind of stuff as well, all in their platform. They sell books. They've built an entire empire based off of one movie and understanding their audience and feeding that audience. That is the future. That is the future of independent filmmaking. It's the only way you can compete. It's the only way you can sustain a living. And that's the biggest thing I always preach is you've got to be able to make a living doing this. It can't be a one-off. You know, you can't make one movie for – let's say you had a $50,000 movie. Well, you can't expect that one $50,000 movie to maintain you for the year. You know, if you have a – you can do it when you're 20. But when you're 30s and your 40s and your 50s, it becomes a little harder. You have to start building an empire. But you got to start building a community. You got to start building a business. And that's where a lot of filmmakers fail. They don't think of it as a business. They get too precious about their first movie and they hold on to it for years and years and years, and you won't make any money with it and you won't be able to get it out there. And when you finally do, a distributor will come in, rape you for whatever they can get out of it. You'll never see a dime, and then you're done. And then another one's been thrown to the side of the road and there's another 50 filmmakers standing right behind you with 50 other movies, and the cycle repeats. And that's where I got upset and kind of launched Indie Film Hustle to kind of put some straight talk out there, from my point of view at least.
All right. So audience building is important. Ideally, should filmmakers or storytellers be doing it even before they launch the project or in the midst of filmmaking?
It's never too early to start building an audience. If you have an idea for a movie that you're trying to make, start building an audience right away. Just start understanding where they hang out, understanding where they, what they like, what they talk about. Start interacting with them. Go, hey guys, I want to make a movie about a vegan chef. What would you guys like to see in the movie? Hey, you know, who would you like to see in the movie? Maybe there's this vegan chef out there who's a real vegan chef and he's maybe a celebrity chef and he would love to do this movie in one way, shape, or form. And all of a sudden now you hire that vegan chef who's probably affordable, or you partner with him and he's got 3 million people following him on Facebook or on YouTube. And all of a sudden you have an audience to sell. And you go with him and you go, hey, I want to make a deal with you. I'm going to split everything with you 50-50. I'm going to make the movie. You're going to be in it. You're going to star in it. We're going to write it together or whatever. And here's a script of it, whatever. I'm just throwing it all out there. And then we're going to sell it to your audience. And I'm going to sell it to – and we're going to sell it. And we're going to do self-distribution through a distributor or something like that. And we're out the door. And all of a sudden, I've just literally laid out a roadmap, a blueprint on how to do – what I'm talking about off the cuff. It's doable. You have to think outside the box though.
That's a good idea. I mean, like you're saying, if you start earlier, you might get casting ideas or special element ideas to include in the story. So that does seem like that could be a useful approach. Mm-hmm. On social media, it seems like you're doing very well with it. You're doing lots of updates, getting a lot of traction. Are you someone who gets energized by doing a lot of that kind of thing? Or is it something that you do as kind of an exercise that needs to be done for the filmmaking side?
It's an exercise that needs to be done. I get jazzed up by interacting with my community and interacting with people that and helping people through those social media platforms. I don't get giddy about Instagram or I got to post this, or I rarely ever do that. Right. It's a job. It's a job. It's part of the job. And I look at it as brushing my teeth, as going to the gym, as daily things, taking a shower. It's got to be done. And if you look at it that way, and you don't have to spend hours on it, you know, you spend 15, 20 minutes every morning posting, organizing yourself for the day, interacting with people, and you can kind of interact during the day a little bit here, a little bit there, depending on how much, you know, how much interaction is asked of you. Cause it's getting to a point now where a lot of people are hitting me up every day. So I try to interact with as many people as I can. But it gets harder and harder as the community gets larger and larger.
But I'm still fairly accessible on certain platforms. And depending on, you know, but I created my community like Indie Film Syndicate. If you're part of Indie Syndicate, you have direct contact to me anytime you want through our Facebook group, through email and things like that. I'm really close to my community. I'm really close to my tribe, as I call them. But that's what I really get excited about. It's just interacting with them, hearing their stories, things like that. But social media is just an ends to a means. But it's a wonderful thing if you know how to use it properly. But it's not the end-all be-all at all. I know a lot of people try to fake it. You know, they buy likes or they buy followers so they look bigger than they are. But I can smell that in a heartbeat. I've been contacted by people and I look at and they're like, yeah, I got like 50,000 followers on Twitter. I'm like, okay. And I look at their interactions and there's just nothing. You know, when you got 50,000 followers, you're going to have 20, 30, 40, 50 retweets on something. At least something, you know what I mean? And I see none of that. Sometimes I'm like, oh, they bought their stuff, you know? Or if I see, oh, they launched 6 months ago and they got 50,000. I'm like, that's rare. It's extremely rare. It takes a lot of time to build that kind of stuff up. So you can kind of smell it. And at the end of the day, it's just like, it's just about ego at that point. Like, you know, buy likes on Facebook. By the way, Facebook is useless. As far as building a page up and getting likes on a page is useless. Build a group up. That's much better.
Going along the lines of what we were talking about, sometimes the social media thing is a little overwhelming for me. I mean, for me, my instinct is to just take some time and process things on my own. But I like what you're saying. I mean, I'm trying to get into that habit of thinking about it as sort of like going to the gym. Mm-hmm. It's not always going to be enjoyable. I mean, it's not always fun, but it's like, no, but this is because something else matters to me that I want to put in the time to do this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's just part of the job. And filmmakers need to understand that this is not part of the job. You know, just like watching movies and learning your craft as a filmmaker at this level, at the indie level, you know, of, you know, $10 million or below budgets, you know, and I've worked on all of them from $10 million to $10,000 movies. You've got to be able to build that community up and build and connect with a community, because you can't afford to spend the money to get that audience. So you have to build that audience organically, and it will take time. It's taken me, I'm closing in July on 2 years with Indie Film Hustle. And it's grown exponentially, much faster than I ever thought it would. But it's a day in, day out. I mean, Nick, you see what I do all the time, all the posts, podcasts.
I was going to say, hats off to you. You're very prolific. You're getting new posts, what, 2 or 3 times a week these days?
About at least 5 to 6 times a week I post something.
Yeah. And doing your other jobs. So how do you balance that? How do you balance doing that kind of constant work with your ongoing film projects and your color grading work that pays the bills?
Man, I tell you, I'm amazed sometimes of what I've been able to do and what I do on a daily basis. It's about time management. It's about creating systems of being able to do stuff like this. You know, I have a lot of systems in place that I'm able to pop things out fairly quickly and not take 4 or 5 hours to do something that might only take me an hour to do. And then just kind of set things up properly, you know, and organize them and schedule them and things like that. But it is doable. But a lot of my contemporaries, like Scott over at Film Trooper and Jason Buff over at Indie Film Academy, we're good friends, and they talk amongst themselves. They told me the other day, like, we have no idea how you do this. Like, we do this and we have no idea how you're doing it. And they've asked me millions of times, and I've told them, but they just like, I just don't get it. It still doesn't make any sense. How are you able to do all of this? And I'm like, man, I really don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mystery to me. Just, I mean, I'm not putting out nearly the amount of content that you are. And even the amount that I'm doing, it takes a decent amount of time. And if I do too much more, then I don't have the time that I'd like to focus on my creative projects. So it's intriguing that you're able to get that going. It sounds like you're setting aside set amounts of time during the day, you know, like X number of hours to work on this. Are you using other tools? Do you have assistants that help maintain the site, or it's still something that you're
I wish I had a system. I wish I had assistants to put things together. I mean, help me. I have a few people who contribute as far as writers are concerned, but I still have to put it all together. I got to create the artwork. I got to, you know, package the actual content on the site and install it and, you know, and schedule it and then market it and all that kind of stuff. I do all of that. So the only help I really get is, you know, I do have some writers who work with me that add some extra content in, you know, a few times a month. But the podcast I do all myself. I'm planning to be doing some more video work coming up in the summer. There's a lot of stuff that I just wish I could even do more. And I think that's probably why I've grown as fast as I have, is because I have been, like you said, prolific in the amount of content I'm able to generate, and quality, hopefully quality content that people really, really like. And the more you show up, like and I'll use Woody Allen again, like 90% of success is just showing up, and showing up day in and day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, and just doing a little bit every day, it builds. It builds little by little, it's brick by brick, and it takes time, you know. And I was able to launch Indie Film Hustle very quickly, and within 3 months, I was the number one, I think, filmmaking podcast on iTunes. Within 3 months, and been able to hang in there, but purely I think because of just the amount of volume of stuff that I do. I mean, I generally do 2 to 3 podcasts a week. Is the goal, and I changed over to 2 a week, like after month 4. I said, oh, this is what it's going to take, so I'm just going to do 2 a week. So at minimum, it's 2, but sometimes it's 3.
And roughly, how long are you spending on each episode to put it together?
If it's an interview, it's going to take the time to interview, like obviously like this hour, like that we're doing. So I would do an hour of interview. Then creating the actual podcast with my intros and outros, probably another 30 minutes there, and then probably another 30 to 35 minutes to put the post together, and it's done. So within 2 to 3 hours, I would say an episode.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
I'm on episode almost episode 150 now.
Yeah.
So I've got a system.
Yeah. Recently, I heard you talking about the shift that you had in perspective, how it doesn't make sense for people starting off to try to emulate the Hollywood look, instead to try to get a distinct point of view. And then with time and experiences and more resources, then aim for that, right? So when did that shift in point of view come about for you?
Look, as much as I might teach through Indie Film Hustle, I learn from Indie Film Hustle and I learn from interacting with filmmakers and also just doing research for content for Indie Film Hustle. So while doing research for the big story was for me was I was attached to another project. It was like a $1 million project that I was going to direct. Went through the whole thing, went to the studio system, went to casting, did castings for it, all the whole ball of wax, and all of a sudden it just went away. It just disintegrated, and the project just dissolved. And I'm like, man, I'm just tired of this. I'm tired of going through this kind of ridiculous roller coaster that I've been doing for the last 20 years, chasing that golden carrot. So I decided, I called up a friend of mine who's a director, and I told him the story, and he's like, dude, you know, you really need to look up someone called Mark Duplass and Joe Swansburg. And I'm like, who are these guys? And I had never heard of them. And he goes, these guys are just popping movies out all the time.
and specifically Swansburg, he made six features. And I'm like, really? Like, that's possible? Like, I just couldn't understand it. So when I started doing research on all of them, then I fell into this whole concept of mumblecore and what these guys were doing. And I was like, okay, this is very interesting. Now, mumblecore is just one avenue of that. But there's a lot of people doing the same thing in horror movies and other genres. And I'm like, well, I can do all of that. And I said, well, I have a lot more experience than they did when they started. When they started, they barely could do anything. They just learned along the way. So I'm like, there's no reason why I can't go out and make my own movie. So if that's the case, then let's go out and make my own movie. And I stopped chasing that that Hollywood golden carrot that they keep telling you and they keep selling you. I was like, you know, I'm just going to make my movie. And I'm going to make it the way I want to make it. And I'm going to sell it to my audience. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And if it works, it works. And I did not attach myself to any outcome. And it was the most freeing artistic thing I've ever done in my life. It was the most enjoy. Can you imagine a feature film with no drama, no hiccups, no problems anywhere along the line from writing it to deliverables? Nothing. Everything just went smoothly. I've never been a part of anything like that in my life. Neither had anybody else that worked with us. Everything just worked. And it was the weirdest experience I've ever had. And it was one of the most wonderful experiences I ever had. And as much as I love, you know, and I knew what kind of movie I was making. So I've done the high budget, big kind of, you know, trying to emulate, you know, Fincher or Nolan or Tarantino or Rodriguez or any of these guys. I've done those movies and they're great. But when you try to achieve, when you try to emulate that kind of production value, I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm saying it's very difficult because, again, it's that whole thing I was talking about earlier, is that it's hard for you to break through because you're hitting too wide. You're trying to hit too wide of a target. If you focus that a little bit, instead of doing shotgun style, do sniper style, if you're going to use gun references, and really pinpoint what kind of movie you want to make and what kind of target audience you can get. It's like, I'm going to go make an action movie that's going to stand up next to a $20 million or a $50 million, $100 million movie, you're going to fail. It's not going to, and I hate to say that way, in that kind of raw way, but you won't be able to compete with that kind of production value, that kind of star power, and try to get to that audience. You might make a really great movie and you might sell it and make some money with it, but it's going to be tough. It's a tough uphill battle, and you got to generate a lot of resources and stuff to get it done. And don't forget, there's so much product out there, so much content that you're competing with. It's not the 90s. It's not even the early 2000s. You know, it's so many movies. Everybody has a feature film now. You know, there's just so many out there. It's a sea of stuff. So that was the shift for me, that I said, you know what, let me just start making my movies the way I want to make them and not try to hit this huge demographic. You know, because I'm not going to be able to do what David Fincher does. Because first of all, we already have a David Fincher. They don't need another one. But I can be inspired by him. I can be inspired by his work, as he was inspired by Kubrick, as Kubrick was inspired by John Ford. You know, and it just goes on, you know, and, you know, Spielberg and Kurosawa and so on. So it's great to be inspired by these giants, these masters of the craft, but trying to play at their playground, it's very difficult, if not impossible, because you just don't have their tools and you don't have their resources. So try to be the best person and the best filmmaker you can be with the resources you can do, and try to tell the best stories that you're capable of telling within the means that you have. If that means that you happen to be Will Smith's buddy and Will Smith wants to show up and do an action movie for you, God bless you. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Must be nice
if that could happen.
Call him in.
Yeah, exactly. But there are those options. You know, I had connections that a lot of people don't have. I have resources that a lot of people don't have. But they're my resources. That's what's my reality. You know, I don't have to worry about post-production because I do it all. Those are resources that I know a lot of filmmakers out there would love. You know, I was able to call Jill Michelle Milian, who's a great actress and has a bunch of amazing friends that we got together to make our movie. I wouldn't have been able to call them. I don't, but she was, and I was able to work with her and have that resource. A lot of filmmakers would love to be able to have that kind of caliber of talent on their first feature film. But that was my reality. That is my set of circumstances. So do whatever it's the best within your circumstances to do. And if you do that, that's when you can succeed.
In some of your earlier episodes of your show, you would talk about how you would try to fake it till you made it kind of thing, or
still doing that, sir.
Yeah. Is that something that you still advise people to do, to say like, okay, well, you know, if you don't have access to this, maybe re-edit, another clip and, at least get practice editing, that kind of thing.
Oh God. Yes, absolutely. My first demo reel was all footage from high-end commercials from Europe, and I made fake commercials with them, and that reel worked for me for about 2 years as an editor in Miami, and people would believe that I made those commercials, and they saw my talent. It's not that
you were presenting yourself as an editor, or they were
editor only. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
yeah, for editing that makes sense. I mean, when you're directing is different, but for an editing or visual effects style, things like that. I mean, yeah, use whatever you can get. Look, it's tough out here. This business is brutal, and whatever you can do to get an edge, do it. As long as it's legal and as long as it's ethical, great. But grabbing some raw footage from another commercial house that I had access to, I didn't steal the footage, I had access to it, and made my own commercials. And if someone asked me straight on, did you direct that? Did you edit that? I'm like, no, it's a spec spot. But for the people who didn't ask, they assumed, and there you go. That's how I got started.
Okay.
You know?
So you would basically say, like, you know, essentially this is your reel as an editor. And it's not like you were outright saying, like, you directed it when you did it.
Oh, God, no, no, okay. You can't do that. Yeah, yeah. That's lying. That's straight up lying. You can't do that.
I gotcha.
Yeah, on an editing standpoint, on a visual effects standpoint, on a color grading standpoint, if you have access to some high-end footage, high-end actors or things like that, you can try to do stuff like that. It's a gray area, and it's a line you've got to dance very carefully, but it can be done. You know, you have to be smart about it. All of a sudden, if you just have, you know, the local car dealership, and all of a sudden you've got a shot of Will Smith in your demo reel,
right,
doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
You know, so you've got to be kind of smart with the hustle.
I've heard you talk in some of your shows about how there've been times when you've gotten so discouraged by the film industry that you were ready to put it aside. Mm-hmm. I can relate to that. I imagine others can as well. What was it that brought you back and said, you know, this is still thing, you know, this part of it makes the rest of it okay?
Having a love for the film industry and being in the film industry is like herpes.
Okay.
You can never get rid of it.
Such a sexy way to sell it there.
I'm telling you, I'm real and I'm raw. It's like herpes. You can't get rid of it. It flares up sometimes and you might want to get away with it, but at the end of the day, it's with you all the time. So it was that exact thing. It's like you can try to quit it, but it's something that will never leave you. Once you've been bitten, it's something that will never leave you. And for me specifically, I've tried leaving multiple times. But I always come back because it's what I love. It's what I know. And by opening up Indie Film Hustle, it reinvigorated my love for not only the business, but for other filmmakers and helping them out. And I found my calling, my path to walk, which is a path that I walked back in 2005 when I made my first short and sold it on DVD and showed people how I made it, when nobody was doing that. So it's not something that brand new to me, but it was something new now. And that's 12 years ago when I did that. So I just found it again. I lost my way. I came back to where I was. And now through this, it's given me the means to be able to create my own art, make my own movies, and help as many filmmakers as I possibly can and guide them in whatever I've learned. I never say I'm a master or a guru of any sort. I'm a schmuck like the rest of you guys, and we're all trying to make it in our own way.
I've been around the block a little bit longer than a lot of you who are listening to me. And I just go, hey, this is what I've learned along the way. It might be right, it might be wrong, but I'll share with you my lessons. And hopefully there'll be some value to you.
I want to take a quick break from our conversation with Alex to tell you a little bit more about some of the things I do when I'm not working on this show. I also work on various film and video projects in various ways. Now, you might be thinking, what an odd time to tell us about this right after Alex described working in the film industry as a sexually transmitted disease. That's not exactly how I would explain it, but I can relate to the sentiment. And so that's part of why I'm mentioning it here. As I've mentioned before, I'm not looking to find lots of additional collaborations. I'm looking to find the right collaborations. Now, what is my background? Well, I would say my strengths are camera department and story. I've been working for Canon for several years now, providing support on our digital SLRs and the cinema equipment. And I've also done some shooting on my projects for others, camera operating. I was recently a director of photography for Home Remedy, a series that'll be on Amazon Prime soon. So I have some experience around cameras. On the story side, I help organize the screenwriters down south here in Baton Rouge, and I read several screenplays a year. I'm working on writing my own projects. I've done some advising on other projects, so I have some background there as well. I'm not saying I have all the answers, but I do believe I could be a valuable part of someone's team, maybe yours. As Alex was mentioning, the film industry comes with all kinds of ups and downs, and I can relate to that. If you want to be an encouragement to me, would you consider just keeping me in mind, especially here in Louisiana? We can at least have a conversation about it. Maybe I can help you. Shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. Once again, podcast@ncivitis.com. Thanks for that. All right, now let's get back to our interview with Alex Ferrari. What would you like to see more filmmakers do or not do to help the filmmaking community thrive a little better?
They need to start thinking of themselves as entrepreneurs and as business people. You have to start thinking about it, not just of the art, but as the business of it. So a friend of mine, Suzanne Lyons, said once that the word show business, the word business has twice as many letters as the word show. And there's a specific reason for that, because without the business, there ain't no show. And everyone has always sold the show and the sparkly lights, but they're not showed the boring stuff, the business, the marketing, the distribution, the this and that. You've got to understand all of it. You have to understand revenue streams. You have to understand how making one movie, you know, you don't just make a movie, put it out through a distributor and hope to get a check. Especially in the indie world, you've got to take control of that. In today's world, there's no reason for you not to be making money. If you're smart about it, you keep those budgets low. I was just talking to a filmmaker the other day. They made a movie for, I don't know, $6,000, I think, $7,000. And they're like, yeah, we're getting an investor. They want to put in 20 to help us with marketing and this and that. I go, why would you do that? She's like, what do you mean? Like, it was mind blowing that I said that. I'm like, why would you take $20,000 of debt onto your company? Basically, your movie. Because now, instead of trying to recoup $6,000, you got to recoup $26,000, and you've got to now pay an investor back. So now the pressure is massive on you to try to make money with a movie that has no stars in it, and it's a little character piece. Doesn't make any sense. You got to think about it as a business. If you have it for $6,000, making $6,000 back, breaking even, there's a chance. $26,000 with no audience and you've never done this before is a much harder sell for you. So think about your movies as a business. Think about all of it as a business, as an entrepreneur. So like, again, I'll use the Vegan Chef example one more time. If you create that movie, you have to think, what other revenue streams can I create from this movie besides just the movie? Use Disney as an example. They made $1 billion off of Frozen in the box office, right? Very successful movie. Off of that, I have a friend of mine who works at Disney, and he told me, do you know how much they made off the dresses? Just the dresses. They made $1 billion on the dresses.
No kidding. Billion with a B on just the dresses.
Just the dresses.
Wow. Not every other godforsaken thing, because I have children, so I'm never want to see that movie again.
Yeah.
But I have girls on top of that, that they made so much money off of that. So much money off of that. It's mind-blowing. But because they understand revenue stream, and this is all the studios understand, revenue streams, different revenue streams. So as independent filmmakers, you have to think outside the box and think of revenue streams. So we'll use that Vegan Chef example movie as the movie as an example. You make a Vegan Chef movie. Well, if you're selling an audience that are vegans, vegetarians, people who are into all natural eating, all that kind of stuff. Well, wouldn't it make sense to maybe put together a chef's course on how to make vegan appetizers, vegan this or vegan that? Wouldn't it be smart to kind of maybe put a cookbook together and team up with a vegan chef and brand it with the brand of the movie? That's what Food Matters did. That's what Forks Over Knives did. These are two documentaries that did exactly that. And they created a line of food that you can buy, and cookbooks and videos and extended videos and courses and things like that. You have to think like that now. You can't just think, oh, I'm going to make a movie, be an artist, and hopefully someone will give me a lot of money. That's where everyone fails. That's why most filmmakers fail. And I just heard a horrible statistic, but it's very true. It was, I think they said 97% of all independent filmmakers lose money.
Wow, that like, high, huh?
Yeah, I heard it somewhere.
That sounds about right.
About 97% of all indie films lose money. They're a horrible, horrible investment. Why? Because they're stuck in the old paradigm. They're stuck in the old system where you make a movie, you sell it to a distributor, you hope for the best. And you don't even sell it anymore. You give it to the distributor. Chances are you'll rarely ever get an upfront fee. Rarely. You hear about them in the trades, but that's rare, super rare. So you give away your movie to a distributor and you hope and pray that you'll see a dollar back. Makes no sense. Makes no sense. It's a horrible business model. Horrible business model. But if you start thinking about it as a business person, as an entrepreneur, as a Shark Tank kind of person, and you start thinking of revenue streams, thinking about it as a business, and maybe it's not one movie, maybe it's three movies, and maybe you don't do them all for $50,000 or $100,000 each. Maybe you make them for $10,000 or $15,000 each. And if you have an audience that is willing to buy that, they don't really care who's in the movie, and so on and so on and so on. It's a lot of possibilities. You know, it has to just – you have to figure it out for yourself what works for you. But there is possibility. It's a lot of work though, but there's a lot of possibility.
All right. Last question for you here. Mm-hmm. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of you?
Wow, that's a great question, actually. Collaborator in what sense? Post, directing?
You can define it however you like.
If I find a producer, let's say, a producer that would want to work with me, it's how to get the best out of me. Let me do my job. And I'll let you do yours. We compartmentalize everything and we'll jump into each other's sandbox when need be. And we give each other our opinions of our each other's jobs, but respect the decision of each other and move forward in that manner. And it's like a marriage, really. You're dating. So it's hard to find good collaborators. That's why Clint Eastwood has worked with the same crew for the last 30 years. That's why Ron Howard works with the same crew that he has for the last 20 years. Because when you find people that you can know and trust and work really well with, you hold on to them and you don't let them go, because it's very difficult to do.
All right. Good answer. So, Alex, people want to learn more about what you do, what you've got to offer. Where could they go to find some of that?
You can go to indiefilmhustle.com. And the podcast and everything is at indiefilmhustle.com. Our Indie Film Syndicate is our membership site where we charge a small fee every month. We have access to, 200-400 video lessons on everything from screenwriting to marketing, every aspect of the production business. And we're adding new courses every month and building that up. And then Indie Film Hustle has the podcast, has articles, and all that kind of stuff. And my directing work, you can see at alexferrari.com. And also, of course, if I'm going to be a media whore, I'll also say my post-production company is numrobot.com. So if you have any needs for color grading, editorial, online editorial, DCPs, anything like that, we can handle all that.
All right. Well, Alex, really appreciate you taking time to share your perspectives. Enjoy the rest of your week and best of wishes on your film, This Is Meg, as it's traveling the festival circuit.
Hey, Nick, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
And that's my interview with Alex Ferrari. A few related thoughts about what we discussed. So first of all, it's great that Alex is able to be so prolific. He's coming out with useful content on a daily basis about the film industry. I don't know how he finds the time, to be honest, but I'm glad that someone is out there providing those resources. It used to be that film production was a very close-knit community. It was very much, you got to know the right person to get this done, to make this deal, to know the intricacies of the things that aren't discussed. With sites like Indie Film Hustle and others out there, a lot of the information is becoming more accessible. It's becoming democratized. It's still about connections. You still have to form those relationships, but now there's a lot of resources out there to help move you in the right direction, to show you information that was once considered secretive, insider baseball kind of stuff. Alex has a number of free resources on his site. He also has a couple of training videos on the Indie Film Syndicate and elsewhere. Quite useful. I've went through some of them. You are getting training sometimes on things like film cameras, where you have someone who's been working with cameras for a while. A lot of information about digital cameras out there, not as much about film cameras, 16 millimeter cameras, or some of the production side. Going back to some of the things that Alex said, from what I understand it, he uses a lookup table to make his footage appear a little darker than it is while he's recording, so that he will overexpose it a little bit to compensate, and then he'll bring it back down when he's doing the edit or the color grade. And for those of you who don't know, a lookup table is a way of displaying images on a camera. It's sort of like making adjustments on your TV to get it to look a certain way. The advantage of doing something like that is certain monitors don't show you a precise representation of what you're capturing, especially the LCD on the camera. It's not always showing you everything going on. So if you do some test, you could say, well, if we shoot in this way, we can then push back the exposure a little bit, like Alex was saying. It's a little easier to make it darker, assuming that your highlights are preserved, and then you have a little more flexibility in post. Adding the lookup table to the monitor while shooting is a shortcut that could come in handy, because you're basically saying, hey, I know what looks good to my eye when I'm shooting, and I'm going to make this adjustment so I don't have to think about it when shooting, and it'll just have those settings that will give me the most amount of flexibility in post. So an interesting technique to try, but you probably want to do some tests before using it. As Alex was saying, connecting with an audience is such a big part of what a filmmaker artist does. And he has several courses on his Indie Film Syndicate about how to build audiences on Twitter, Facebook, and so on. They're helpful resources to check out. It is something that each person should think about how they want to approach their promotional efforts. It shouldn't always be the same. I would say my style is going to be a little different than Alex's or others. There are people who do social media in a way that makes me want to say, I don't really want to work with this person at all. I want to stay far, far away, or I don't want to do an interview. So I thought it would be interesting to share some of my thoughts on social media. I'm not the social media expert by any means, but I know what works for me and what doesn't. And so take that with a grain of salt. The ones I'm most active on are Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I have been thinking about doing something on YouTube, but I haven't figured out what I want to do. So if you have suggestions about that, I'm open to hearing it. Anyway, for me, I enjoy Facebook more because it feels like I'm actually building relationships with people. Many of the people on there are people I know in some way or hope to get to know better. With Twitter, it's more broad. There is this sense of that self-promotional aspect, which isn't bad. I mean, I use it for that too, but some people use it in such a way where it's overwhelming. And if given the choice, what am I going to check during the day? I'd prefer to check Facebook because it's like, oh, I'm hearing about my friends as opposed to I'm seeing the stream of self-promotional updates and things that make me despair. There are days when I look at Twitter and I think, please, someone, just say something soulful, one soulful, earnest thing, someone. A lot of times I don't find it, and that's discouraging. Sometimes I find it on Facebook. So there are different platforms, different ways of going about it, but it is an important approach. For me, I want my updates on the different sites to give some sense of who I am. Not that you're going to post everything, but I do aim for honesty on occasion. I sometimes think it's important to not just post that, like, hey, I'm so great. Check out how awesome I am. The new thing, the new film album is coming out tomorrow. You're going to buy it, right? You're going to buy it, play it, listen, share it, make it go viral, people. As if the most important thing in the world is making sure that everybody possible buys the new thing right now. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's a factor. That's how people make a living. But is that the most important thing, right? And someone dies, like their deathbed regrets, oh, if only I had posted 15 more times a day on Twitter, where could I have gone? Can you imagine the places I could have gone? If only I could have gotten 5 million more people to buy my album, then I would have beaten that other person, and then I'd get the award, not him or her, and then my museum would be even bigger than his. Can you believe that? That's not what I want to think about when I'm dying. Maybe you do. I don't know. But there are other parts of who we are beyond the promotional side, you know? And I've noticed this, it's a little strange. Sometimes even the big artists do this, and you connect with the things that they do in their performances. It's an honest performance on film or on album, book. And then the promotional thing is just like, hey, how are you? Good to see you. Buy my album, buy the book, buy the movie. Do it today. Subscribe, share it. It's a part of it, but I just wish that we could see more of people than just that on some of these sites. But what do I know? The Kardashians are making millions of dollars and getting paid to tweet about things or include them in their Instagram or whatever. So maybe you should listen to them. You know, maybe we could have a whole nation of Kardashians. Wouldn't that be great? Everyone, you too are Kardashian. You can do it too. Just do what they do. Yeah, there's a better than average chance that I'm going to end up a misanthrope, drinking all the time when I go back to drinking. Like, oh, I can't stand anyone. And I'm a little sad about that. I hope I don't become that way, but I don't know. We'll see. Now, there is another side to it, though. When I was a little younger, I was more apprehensive of the social media metrics. I'd roll my eyes when people start talking about how many Twitter followers they have or whatever. But I've come to realize it's not always just a vanity thing. Sometimes it's about helping a business thrive. If you have something you're selling or trying to promote, trying to make a living from your efforts, the larger the audience you have on these platforms, the higher percent of people will respond to the things you share. Even if it's just a 1% or 5% response rate, and that's what people say sometimes for email marketing, right? Certain email marketing campaigns are considered successful if they get between a 3% and 5% conversion rate. So you think about that in terms of social media. Well, yeah, in some cases it does make sense to have more. It is about helping to build something. So there's value in that. There's no reason to scoff at that. And it is worth pursuing, exploring different ways to grow an audience through those platforms. It's just numbers aren't everything. I would say Alex does a decent mix of talking about his stuff, but also sharing useful information. So that's one way to do it. Or just personal information. Here's what's going on with me. The occasional thing where it's like, hey, here's one instance where I'm going to reach out and tell you what's going on. Honestly, that's not polished. I'm going to share that one photo that hasn't been photoshopped to death, right? Like a beautiful skin that looks too soft. Like, girl, I don't think you really just took that. It looks like you used some skin softener on that. Your eyes are much sharper than for all of your photos, girl. Okay. We live in this self-curating world where there's this pressure to present the most polished version of ourselves all the time. And sometimes there's appeal to that. I mean, you want to look presentable, put your best foot forward and all that, but there's value in the occasional unpolished post or photo or whatever, at least to me. Of course, we want to promote the things we work hard on. Some of these things, films, albums, art projects, books, whatever, those things take years or can take years to put together. So we want to share it. That makes sense. But there's also value in extending the conversation beyond that. And sometimes the social media sites or people who promote on there who do it incessantly or who leave a bad taste in your mouth after seeing what they share, sometimes I suspect that might be coming from a place of insecurity. Some of these people, I meet them and I think, hey, I connect with this person. This isn't at all how you represent yourself socially. And I actually like this person here hanging out, but I don't know why you're presenting yourself that way online and so differently. Is there some kind of insecurity there? Maybe there is, right? The subtext behind what someone shares might be something like, well, I've been working on this for so long and I haven't made any money and I don't know what I'm going to do and I've got to do something. Or I'm so heartbroken that this relationship didn't work out, so I've got to pretend like I don't care and talk about this. Who knows? We can only go by what people tell us. And if they only tell us the promotional side, then we can't get a better sense of what they're really struggling with, which means we might not be able to help them, support them in the areas where they are really struggling. It comes up sometimes. I mean, you have people, the high performers, doing so well, it seems they look so happy from a distance. And then you find out that they died from their own hand. They committed suicide. They overdosed on drugs. What happened? He looks so happy. She looks so happy from a distance. What if they had said, well, here's what's really going on? Might that have changed things? So along those lines, let's talk a little bit about Alex's analogy on the film industry, because it's something I can relate to. It's something I've been wrestling with lately. I was a little amused that he chose to compare the pursuit of film to herpes, something that you can't get rid of and it's unpleasant, but it's there. It's part of you. Well, yeah, it's there is that. There are ups and downs. And I do appreciate Alex's honesty about it. He will share on occasion some of the frustrations that come up with the industry. And that's valuable. I mean, there are times when I think, would I have done it differently? Should I have gone into law school like I was thinking? And I wish I could always say, well, no, I have absolutely no regrets. It's been great, smooth sailing ever since. No, there are days when I think about it quite a bit lately, actually. There have been a number of disheartening things, film-related, or that have come up because I've been pursuing this crazy industry. And I go back and think, like, if I were to go back and try to convince myself, hey, maybe reconsider, maybe go another route. There are some days that I might do that if I had that ability. And I thought, well, what would I do? You know, what would I say to go back and change my mind? I mean, if I were to go back to my younger self, my more idealistic self, and say, hey, Nick, just so you know, this industry you're pursuing, it's going to break your heart in so many ways that you don't even understand. So many people that you admire right now, you're going to get to see them a little closer, and what you're going to see is going to break your heart because they're not always what they appear to be. I probably would not believe myself. Like, no, who are you, guy? I don't know who you are. I'm not going to listen to you. There's no way that people could be that callous or cowardly or fraudulent, because it's the film industry. It's movies, and movies are great. And so I was thinking, well, what would it take? Well, if I were to go back and say, all right, Nick, take a look at who you've become because of your pursuit of this industry. Look at how cynical you have become. Look at some of the things you've done, in part because some of the things you faced have hurt so much. Are you sure this is still what you want? That would be a persuasive argument. That would be something that I would say, well, okay, maybe you're right. Back then, I was much more inclined to believe the idea of listen to your heart and things will work out if your heart's in the right place. Not because it had worked out in the past for me, but because that wasn't something I really knew how to do. And I wanted to. I wanted to live from the heart more often. I wish I could still embrace it. It's a nice idea, but more realistically, I think, well, hey, you're going to face some of these people, you better bring an army. I used to think, hey, everything happens for a reason. It all makes sense, or it will all make sense someday if your heart's in the right place. Now, I'm sometimes prone to think things might happen for a reason, but it's because a lot of people are egomaniacal, conniving, venal, petty. I wish I didn't see the world that way, at least not sometimes. It's not how I always see it, but it creeps in. It's becoming a more and more influential worldview, unfortunately. And as I mentioned earlier, I think there's a better than average chance that I'll end up a jaded misanthrope prone to drinking to console myself. I hope not. But it seems like that's becoming harder and harder to resist. And the really unsettling thing is that I became a little bit more like that, in part because I listened to my heart all those years ago, because I tried to follow that little spark, that idealism that initially brought me to the film industry. These comments are a little more dissonant than usual, but I do believe it's important to acknowledge that it's not always a glamorous thing. It's hard and discouraging in so many ways sometimes, and it might just be that certain recent events are on my mind, certain discouragements, people I had hoped would stand up for me, haven't. They remain silent. Some of them for years because, well, they've got their reasons, I'm sure. But it does take a toll. And sometimes it's the little things, too. Maybe something encouraging will happen and I will change my tune. But these are underlying issues. They've been there for a while, for several years. And so when new little frustrations, new little hiccups come up. It's sort of a cumulative effect. It's not just a one-time thing. And you know, part of it too, was going back and rewatching Jeff Who Lives at Home. As I mentioned in the last episode, there's a special connection I have to that film. You can hear more about it if you go back and listen to it. It's the episode with Xanaronda. And so I mentioned I wanted to go back and give it another look in context of what happened. Jeff, Who Lives at Home, is one of the films from the Duplass brothers, and Alex has mentioned his admiration of their work. So it does relate to this episode as well. But anyway, I went back and watched, and oh man, what a bittersweet experience that was. To give you some context, I first saw the film, I believe, shortly after I came to Baton Rouge. It was around that time. I came to Baton Rouge August 2011, and the film came out early 2012. I saw it around the time when it came out, I believe. That film is set in Baton Rouge, and there's also a character in it, Jeff, who very much looks for signs and believes that everything happens for a reason. The film starts out with one of his quotes where he says, "Everyone and everything is interconnected in this universe. Stay pure of heart and you will see the signs. Follow the signs and you will uncover your destiny." And the entire film tests that. Jeff wants to believe that, but he faces some discouraging things, some seemingly random things. He's still trying to make sense of it. But in the end, things work out, at least in the film. And when I first saw the film, I took it as a sign that coming to Baton Rouge was the right step forward, something I was meant to do. The film was a validation of that. Watching it now, I couldn't help but think of all the heartbreaking things that have happened to me since I've been here. A number of the discouraging encounters I mentioned in the film industry have happened here. At the same time, it reminded me of what it was like believing that things work out. I like myself a little bit more when I have that idealism. So watching the movie made me think, did I make a mistake? Did I get it wrong? Or are my growing misanthropic tendencies things that would come up regardless of whether I was pursuing film? Would it be so different if I chose to go into law and not film? I'm fairly certain I would be making more money as a lawyer right now, but money isn't everything. Would I have been a better person? Hard to say. It wasn't like I was the ideal person when I was making that decision. I wouldn't have run into some of the people who have caused me such frustration in the film industry, but I'm sure there are would have been comparable people in law. I do want to believe that things happen for a reason, that it all works out somehow. And that's part of why watching Jeff Who Lives at Home again was so bittersweet, because on the one hand, I've become more cynical, but there's still a part of me that sees that kind of film and says, hey, maybe it could work out. There are still some possibilities. They are distant, very unlikely at this point. But it's still possible that everything will work out. It comes down to this. If one particular person gets back to me in some kind of personable, considerate way, then it will mean that I wasn't wrong about everything, that maybe there is some kind of reason for it all. The chance that such a thing will happen is very unlikely, it seems. I don't anticipate another situation where I will reach out to her again, unless something really unexpected happens on some kind of epic scale, or if she gets back to me. She's had plenty of opportunities in the past to respond, but she hasn't. So what's going to change it now? I don't know. If she's just like all the other people in the industry, there's no reason whatsoever for her to reach out to me at this point. But for whatever reason, I have this sense that she is somehow different, that maybe there's something about it all that I don't understand. If she did get back to me, that would be different. It would be unlike what so many others have been unable to do. It would completely break my model of how certain industry insiders operate. And since I'm not planning on following up with her, it really would be a notable thing to hear back. Anyone who manages to defy my long fermented perceptions about the entertainment industry is remarkable in some way. If she gets back to me, she might be the most remarkable of them all. All I have is a sense that it might lead to something. Very similar to that sense I have about those numbers. Number 23 keeps showing up. And every now and then I get this sense that it might lead somewhere. But I've got no proof for that either. I mentioned last episode that it is quite possible that I've been seeing the number because I've been looking for it, confirmation bias. So I said, well, I'm going to start looking for the not 23, number 17, see if it shows up. And I've been looking, haven't seen it since last episode. You know, I did see the number 23, though, came up a couple times. It came up in Jeff Who Lives at Home, the time of the film. Runtime is listed on the DVD cover. 1 hour, 23 minutes. I went back and rewatched Blue Jay, a prominent film from last episode, to see if I missed something the first time. I was curious to see if the number 17 was in there somewhere. Didn't find that number, but I did find the number 23. Somehow I had missed it the first time, or just chose not to make note of it because these things come up and sometimes I ignore them. But it was mentioned more than once in the film. Not a numbers film. It's not like they're like, and now 17, and now 18, 19, 20. I don't remember them mentioning lots of other numbers multiple times, but, you know, it's what it is. It's very strange. And the number came up even in context to this interview. It's, in fact, the date that Alex selected to do the interview, March 23rd. Yeah, I know it's been a while. I've gotten a little bit behind schedule, but anyway, we tried a couple times to schedule things on different days. The other days didn't work out. He suggested the 23rd, and it did. I mean, I tried to make it work on the other days, but scheduling things came up on my end or his end, and then 23, it works out. So maybe that was just Alex knowing the show, being smart enough to humor me on my strange obsession. All right. I mean, there are worse ways to go. At least he didn't pick number 17. Ominous number. Number 17 is my court date this month. Yeah. Looking forward to that. Let's see if my fortune or lack thereof is consistent, carried out into the courtroom and so on. So as a side note, if a future guest were to message me and we're trying to figure out when to do the interview and the guest suggests the 17th, I will be a little more apprehensive. Especially if the guest is like, oh, I've heard all your episodes. I love it. I am so excited about the show. Let's book it on the 17th. I'm like, okay. But picking the 23rd might get my attention in a more positive way. I mean, not saying that I'll do it on that day. I'm just saying maybe you listen to the show or the stars have aligned or whatever. I don't know, but give me something else to ponder about in the evenings. Anyway, it's that number that keeps showing up. Even when I try to avoid it, it comes up in all kinds of unusual ways. And I still have the sense that maybe it leads to something, similar to that sense I have about that person who might be different than everyone else. Not saying she is, it's just a sense I have that she might be. You know, this sense of things, I had this sense that I should come out to Baton Rouge. And that led to this podcast. So if you've ever gotten anything of merit from this podcast on all the different episodes I've done, you have that peculiar sense to thank. Whatever that's worth, I don't know. Just think, you could have been going to another film networking event, but you chose to listen to this for whatever reason. I thank you for it. I hope it has been useful to you in some way. Okay, that's our show. What are your thoughts? Any comments you want to share? Any thoughts or preferences about how you like to manage social media or what you like to see from the accounts you follow? Or just some of the film-related things? Welcome to discuss those too. Cameras, workflow, whatever. Leave a comment or shoot me an email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. And again, be sure to check out some of Alex's resources, a number of free resources on his site, Indie Film Hustle. He also has the paid classes that you can take if you want to learn more about film cameras or RED cameras or social media or just so many of the other topics he has. I would say it's worth checking out. As I was working on this show, Alex sent me an update that he recently directed a series for Legendary Pictures and Nerdist called Space Program. It is also expected to be out in the summer, along with his film, This Is Meg. And again, you can look for that one on iTunes. Details of the things that we discussed will be on the show notes, so look for them if you're interested. Music for the show, beginning and the end here, provided by Rob Coslow. It's the song True Gemini. And what else would it be? All right. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.